So, functional regulation could more appropriately be called dysfunctional regulation. Some of what we think of as the bubble of 1997 to 2000 was a side effect of massive, permissive deregulation, not just of finance, but of energy and telecommunications, both in 1996. These were two other industries where egregious misbehaviors, Enron and WorldCom, became poster children of speculative havoc. During the boom, the energy and telecom sectors each issued roughly $1 trillion worth of new debt, manna for the financial services industry. Despite the enormous stakes, federal deregulatory and financial statutes provided scarcely more of a framework for imposing social values and behavioral requirements on newly ascendant financial services than had existed in the regulatory vacuum of the late 19th century. Those, of course, were the years when railroad became a verb as well as a noun, as in to railroad a bill through a supine legislature. Parallels to the deficit in social consciousness on the part of the FIRE sector abound. The United States took decades in the late 19th century to regulate working conditions for children. Current-day critics saw as much need to deal with the conditions that enticed young Americans into taking on crippling debt. Sociologist Robert Manning later detailed how banking deregulation during the late 1990s facilitated an enormously successful mass marketing campaign that dramatically altered American attitudes toward consumer credit and debt, not least on the part of teenagers. "The key is here," he had said, "as the marketing of consumption goes younger and younger and younger. We're talking about people who have never had jobs and haven't had to establish a budget." Similarly, Boston economist Juliet Shore argued that advertising had drawn children into rampant and gullible materialism. Noting how consumer spending accounted for more than two-thirds of the $11 trillion national economy, the New York Times summarized that the machinery of American marketing, media, and finance all encourage the consumption habit. Many consumers are unable to resist the overpowering mantra, spend, spend, spend. True, overconsumption is not ideally addressed in a political arena, but considerations beyond finance pull it there today. For example, experts estimated that fraud, such as acceptance by lending institutions of inflated property valuations, was present in at least 20% of loans that wound up in foreclosure. Margot Saunders, an attorney at Washington's National Consumer Law Center, added a telling point. Credit is not just a benefit. It is also a dangerous instrument. Everything from cars to toasters that have some danger are regulated, but loans which can cause such devastation when provided in the wrong situation are not regulated. The need for a broader regulatory assessment of financial legislation seems to leap out. Nor can market forces be the sole criteria in justifying how the debt and credit explosion made elderly Americans reaching retirement during the early 2000s less likely to own their homes than before. Those over 65, said the New York Times, not only have the fastest growing home debt, but also the fastest growing share of bankruptcy filings and the biggest growth in demand for credit counseling. More and more of the elderly are in outright financial distress. One in seven households headed by someone 65 or older was considered heavily indebted in 2001, devoting at least 40% of their incomes to debt payments, according to the Federal Reserve's Survey of Consumer Finances. Such practices seem unsafe on the micro level as well as the macro. Worsening the burden on the elderly was the trend reported in a February 2005 study for the medical policy journal Health Affairs. Between 1981 and 2001, medical-related bankruptcies increased by 2,200%, a spike that far exceeded the 360% growth in overall personal bankruptcies during the same time period. Medical-related debt had become the second leading cause of personal bankruptcy, partly because of the widening lack of health insurance, with the number of uninsured rising to 45 million. One of the study's authors, Harvard Law School professor Elizabeth Warren, observed that the people we found to be profoundly affected are not some distant underclass. They're the very heart of the middle class. These are educated Americans with decent jobs, homes, and families. But one stumble and they end up in complete financial collapse, wiped out by medical bills. Values beyond those of the market might also have reversed Alan Greenspan's decision not to prick the turn-of-the-century stock bubble. His case for not doing so, laid out in 2002 and again in 2004, withered alongside contrary theory and weighty evidence from the Bank for International Settlements, BIS, the International Monetary Fund, the European Central Bank, and elsewhere. A study prepared for the BIS, analyzing 34 countries since 1960, concluded, in the words of The Economist, that a simultaneous surge in both credit and asset prices gives a pretty reliable warning of financial problems ahead. The case for a rise in interest rates is therefore stronger when asset price rises go hand in hand with rapid growth in credit, as in America in the late 1990s. As for the serial liquidity that replaced the stock bubble with a housing bubble, the IMF in 2003 conducted a detailed study of previous property slumps in the United States and 13 other industrialized countries. The conclusion was that a real estate bust less than half as large as a decline in stock prices had typically proved twice as dangerous to national economies, with effects lasting twice as long. Should a fall in real estate prices in the 2000s bring the tumbling economic dominoes avoided earlier, the Federal Reserve Board's decisions might be re-examined under a cruel lens. Can bubble popping be left to the whim of a central bank blinded by fealty to finance? Can unsafe credit practices be allowed when unsafe industrial practices have been regulated or prohibited? We shall see. If the financial services industry has risen to new heights of influence and economic dominance, its predilections and practices seem to march to a familiar drummer. Greed and the 1995 to 2005 credit bubble. Philosophically, the several waves of Washington's conservative-led liberation of financial services contradicted the sounder sort of conservatism, the ideology of a John Adams, a George Washington, or a Theodore Roosevelt, cognizant of the effects of greed and the need to constrain it. Deregulatory thinking, predicated on an exaggeration of Adam Smith's vaunted invisible hand, simply presupposed the legitimacy of whatever so-called market forces might produce. Preening after the enactment of the 1999 legislation, Phil Graham, the chairman of the Senate Banking Committee, proclaimed that instead of regulation, we believe freedom is the answer. Freedom for the financial sector, that is. What simultaneously triumphed, unfortunately, was ignorance of history and a classic onset of greed. Risk eloped with avarice in heady expectation, even while the memory of the NASDAQ crash and Enron was still fresh. These liaisons justified fear that the credit or serial liquidity bubble was an extension and enlargement of the first crisis, not merely an aftershock. Credit card issuers turned buccaneer, helping to lure Americans into record debt, after gaining final approval in the late 1990s to charge customers virtually whatever interest rates and fees they wanted, and with flimsy excuses. By 2005, as we will see, nearly 40% of the typical issuer's profits came from penalty fees. Duncan MacDonald, a lawyer for Citibank in the 1996 Supreme Court case deregulating credit card fees, told the New York Times in 2004, "I didn't imagine that someday we might have ended up creating a Frankenstein." Hedge funds and exotic derivative instruments, including CDOs that pooled everything from snowmobile loans to plastic surgery payment streams, picked up where Enron croupiers had left off. Financial sector debt doubled during the 5 years following the NASDAQ crash. By 2005, it totaled three times as much as the NASDAQ equity vaporized earlier. Housing may be part of the larger casino. As real estate values soared with the help of Federal Reserve Board rate cuts, new varieties of mortgages, as we will see, turned homes into ATM machines and loan terms into crapshoots. Hundreds of different agreements facilitated a wide range of housing market, economic, and interest rate gambles. By 2005, homes, not stocks, were the principal base of U.S. household net worth. In contrast to what unfolded after 1929, the controversies over financial practices actually grew after 2000 as the Nasdaq crash led only into new dimensions of debt, themselves hinting at further global jeopardy. But we are getting ahead of ourselves. The United States is hardly the first nation to lose itself in financial ambitions and self-congratulation. The precedents of the earlier leading world economic powers, alas, make the fallibility and danger points all too clear. Chapter 9. Debt: History's Unlearned Lesson. The only thing new in the world is the history we don't know. Harry S. Truman. Historically, the financialization of society has always been a symbol that a nation's economic position has entered a phase of deterioration. William Wallman and Ann Kolomaska, The Judas Economy, 1997. The lesson of history is that we don't learn the lessons of history. Thomas G. Donlan, Barron's, 2005. Because the past repeats only in general resemblance, there is always something different, something new. This truth, together with the usual effects of the passage of time, makes it easy for later generations to dismiss any awkward precedents. And so it has been with the demobilization of manufacturing and embrace of debt in the contemporary United States. Like other leading world economic powers, we tell ourselves we are special, unique, sui generis, and God's chosen nation, the new people of the covenant. Economic as well as political and religious smugness threads through each historical sequence. A 17th century Spaniard enthused, "Let London manufacture those fine fabrics, Holland her chambrays, Florence her cloth, the Indies their beaver and vicuna, Milan her brooches, India and Flanders their linens, so long as our capital can enjoy them." The only thing it proves is that all nations train journeymen for Madrid, and that Madrid is the queen of parliaments, for all the world serves her, and she serves nobody. A similar Dutch conceit was sculpted into the decorative exterior of the great Amsterdam town hall, begun in the glory year of 1648, which showed that city receiving the tribute of four continents, Europe, Africa, Asia, and North America, while a Dutch atlas supported the globe on his back. In Britain, economist W.S. Jevons caught the similar self-assurance of the Victorian era. "The plains of North America and Russia are our cornfields. Chicago and Odessa are our granaries. Canada and the Baltic are our timber forests. Australia contains our sheep farms, and in Argentina and on the western prairies of North America are our herds of oxen. Peru sends her silver, and the gold of South Africa and Australia flows to London. The Hindus and Chinese grow tea for us, and our coffee, sugar, and spice plantations are all in the Indies. Spain and France are our vineyards, and the Mediterranean our fruit garden." Not anymore, of course. Few contemplate Madrid. The Dutch Atlas has put down his lonely burden, and the sun has set on the British Empire. The recent echoes of yesteryear's smugness come from the fanfares of American empire, so popular before the occupation of Iraq fomented such disillusion. And still, conductors of the orchestra of American hubris wave star-spangled batons, and the chorus still resounds. Washington rules. The world manufactures for the United States, and our current account deficit reflects nothing more than global anxiety about investing in U.S. prosperity. Who knows? The Treasury may even be planning a statue of an American consumer supporting the world on his back. However, if pride goeth before a fall, cocksureness about the manageability of U.S. public and private indebtedness may as well, given threats that range from debt crises to currency humiliations. Crippling indebtedness is like the ghost of leading world economic powers past, a familiar Shakespearean villain come to stalk the current hegemon. Finance, the end game of champions. Nations do not easily become the leading world purveyor of financial services. Habsburg Spain rode a flood of bullion from the New World, spreading it around Europe and employing the expertise of moneymen from Augsburg, Antwerp, Genoa, and Venice. The Dutch turned Amsterdam into Europe's top entrepot, offered the continent's lowest-cost capital, and launched a maritime supremacy that stretched from Japan and the East Indies to New Amsterdam and the Cape of Good Hope. Britain constructed the world's greatest colonial empire and took over maritime and financial supremacy from the Dutch. The United States built the world's number one industrial power, provided the oil and money for victory in two world wars, and assumed financial leadership from Britain. None of these hegemons started with well-developed international finance. They began with simpler vocations. Castile, the heart of Spain, was a culture of high plateau wool growers and skilled soldiers who had spent centuries reconquering the Iberian Peninsula from Muslim emirs before conquistadors found gold and silver in Central and South America. The Dutch, as we have seen, had a unique talent for vocations having to do with ships, seas, and winds. The English pioneered in coal development and superseded the Dutch as masters of the seas. But after several generations of success in soldiering, seafaring, or manufacturing, these peoples, in their respective heydays, were drawn farther in the direction of globalism, financial services, and capital management. In the case of Spain, the reorientation came in mere decades, driven by the gold and silver mined in huge quantities in the Americas and shipped as bullion back to Seville in great treasure fleets. The Spanish crown deployed that massive purchasing power to underwrite ventures from the Catholic Counter-Reformation and war in the Low Countries to the expensive and lazy importation of manufactured goods. The Castilians who ruled Spain were not entrepreneurs, but in 1517 a multiple royal inheritance joined Spain to the Habsburg Empire. In addition to the new American colonies, this combined monarchy soon sprawled across the Low Countries, much of Italy, Portugal, and part of Germany. These happened to be the European mercantile and financial centers of the 16th century. The extraordinary coming together occurred when Charles of Burgundy, the grandson of Ferdinand and Isabella of Spain on one side and Maximilian of Austria on the other, inherited the Spanish throne, Burgundy, the Low Countries, and Austria, and then became Holy Roman Emperor in his Habsburg capacity. Without the commercial Flemings, Dutch, Lombards, and Genoese, a Spain captained by militarily and religiously driven Castilians might not have raised its economic flag so high. However, through its new Habsburg reach, Castile enlisted much of Europe's financial acumen, even though revolt against Habsburg rule broke out among the Dutch in 1568. Arrayed together, Spain's wealth and Flemish, Italian, and German mercantile talents made Spain a financial power until its war-related ruination in the 1640s. In several unusual ways, to which we will return, Habsburg Spain developed aspects of a financial services empire. Hitherto, that specialty had been confined to small city-states, most notably Venice and Genoa. From the mid-16th century to early in the 17th, however, many Genoese, Germans, and Flemings relocated to Madrid, Seville, Cadiz, and other Spanish centers. What Spain never enjoyed or passed through was a serious manufacturing era. As the gold and silver inflows mounted in the 1550s and 1560s, Spain became a financial feeding trough, its ports, commerce, and mercantile facilities largely controlled by outsiders. Excluding the unusual case of Spain, the leading economic powers have followed an evolutionary progression. First, agriculture, fishing, and the like. Next, commerce and industry, and finally, finance. Several historians have elaborated this point. Brooks Adams contended that as societies consolidate, they pass through a profound intellectual change. Energy ceases to vent through the imagination and takes the form of capital. Will and Ariel Durant explained that history repeats, but only in outline and in the large. We may reasonably expect that in the future, as in the past, that new civilizations will begin with pasture and agriculture, expand into commerce and industry, and luxuriate in finance. In 1908, as we have seen, Winston Churchill, then Britain's president of the Board of Trade, vented a similar historical interpretation in finding the seed of imperial ruin and national decay in the unnatural gap between the rich and the poor, and the swift increase of vulgar, jobless luxury. This bespoke finance, then emerging powerfully in the United Kingdom. And the French scholar Fernand Braudel observed that the long perspectives of history suggest, perhaps fallaciously, that economic life is subject to slow-moving rhythms. The splendid cities of medieval Italy, whose decline took gradual shape in the 16th century, often began by building on the profits from road or sea transport. It was thus with Asti, with Venice, with Genoa. This was followed by mercantile activity, then by industrial development. Finally, the crowning touch, the growth of banking. Inverse proof, the decline affected, successfully, and sometimes at very great intervals, and not without occasional brief revivals, transport, then commerce, then industry, allowing banking activities to survive long after the others. In the 18th century, Venice and Genoa were still centers of finance. A leading 20th century historian of Spain, Sir John Eliot, related that nation's decline to its reliance on gold, silver, and debt, its passive acceptance of finance. He also ruminated on how many Spaniards, by 1600 becoming aware of their country's apparent declinación, repeated the analogies of Polybius, the Roman historian, who likened the lifespans of great nations to the growth, maturity, and decay of living organisms. In a 1997 book indicting the emerging U.S. version of what he called the Judas economy, William Woolman, chief economist for Businessweek, noted the reiteration of this familiar menace. The best historians have noticed that in each major phase of the development of capitalism, the leading country of the capitalist world goes through a period of financialization, wherein the most important economic dynamic is the creation and trading of abstract financial instruments rather than the production of genuine goods and services. This is a behavioral pattern, true enough, at least to date, that Americans must ponder. Spain, hardly a nation modern Anglo-Saxons pay much attention to, may have a unique relevance. The warnings it offers as the Western world's first major Judas economy, where finance triumphed and work decayed. Spain became something that economists particularly have not grasped. While the Netherlands, Britain, and the United States have all followed the familiar capitalist evolution in elevating finance, the perverse Spanish example is important. Before 16th century treasure fleets crossed the Atlantic, Spain had the small outlines of wool, textile, and iron and steel industries, as well as a minor bourgeoisie. But the large-scale arrival of bullion, year after year, was inflationary and sent the prices of local products climbing to levels that made them non-competitive and simultaneously diminished Spaniards' desire to work for anything but easy gains. Historians have ascribed these changes to the fostering of a bonanza mentality and to the emergence of Seville, the chief treasure port, as an El Dorado symbol and magnet for fortune seekers. More broadly, the general verdict of commentators has been that gold and silver reigned on Spain without ever greening its real economy. The would-be 17th century reformer González de Sayorigo explained that money was not true wealth, and that Spain's future was being dissipated on thin air, on papers, contracts, censos, loans, and letters of exchange, on cash and silver and gold, instead of being expended on things that yield profits and attract riches from outside to augment the riches within. Foreign observers said much the same thing. One historian concluded that for two centuries, Spain squandered its wealth and manpower. Perhaps, But for a limited comparison with the latter-day United States, this description begs the issue. Nothing even resembling gross domestic product or gross national product data is available for 16th and 17th century Spain. But if it were, what might it show? After gold and silver began flooding Spain, agriculture and what industry there was withered. Ambitious persons decamped for the Madrid of organized religion, the Habsburg court, and the treasure port of Seville. Through 1620 or so, these three were the flourishing economic sectors. As such, they must have produced a significant GDP. Booming Seville, with a population of 150,000, became Europe's third city after Paris and Naples. And in 1585, the Spanish merchant fleet, by one count, rivaled the Dutch, doubled the German, Hanseatic, and trebled the English and French. Madrid, two-thirds the size of Seville, thronged with bureaucrats, court parasites, and luxury purveyors. We shall hear about the foreign financial services vendors there momentarily. No small part of Madrid's royal and church wealth came from bullion. The crown took one-fifth of the gold and silver, and other fees, duties, and thinly disguised extortions were legion. The church and religious houses like the Jesuits, largely untaxed, drew great returns from Spanish America. By the 18th century, the Jesuits, with their lands and mines, were reckoned to be the biggest slaveholders in South America. The large, foreign-dominated mercantile and financial communities in Madrid and Seville gorged on legitimate trade, bullion smuggling, tax collecting on behalf of the government, silver brokerage, insurance arrangements, bills of exchange, and investments in various forms of debt instruments. The Castilian Parliament, furious at the property rights and preferences accorded foreign financiers, protested in 1548 that a consequence of your majesty's loans in Germany and Italy is that a great number of foreigners have come here. They are not satisfied just with their profits from banking, nor with obtaining property, bishoprics, and estates, but are buying up all the wool, silk, leather, and other goods. Of the 29 million ducats Charles V borrowed from bankers, 21.9 million came from Genoese and Germans. Historians and economists are only beginning to piece together the volumes and profits involved. Many of the nobility or lesser hidalgo class, along with churchmen and the various religious orders, were on the rentier side, deriving much of their income from offices purchased or awarded, investments in the colonies, and debt instruments called juros. The latter were cherished linchpins of a highly elaborate credit system, a system which no doubt received much of its impetus from the exigencies of the crown's finances. Anyone with money to spare, a noble, a merchant, or a wealthy peasant, or institutions like convents, could lend it to private persons, or municipal corporations, or else to the crown, at a guaranteed 5%, 7%, or 10%. Such opportunities, indirectly enabled by bullion, shrank the pool of capital available for bolder ventures. Like debt in the U.S. GDP of the early 2000s, juros and other forms of indebtedness likely added up to a disconcerting share of the Spanish GDP circa 1600. In addition to these components, the role of Spain in importing and diffusing New World gold and silver was a powerful global force during the 16th and early 17th centuries. Between 1540 and 1660, a total of 16,900 tons of silver and 181 tons of gold came to Europe, the largest proportional increase in bullion ever, and enough to expand the money stock of Europe by about 50% by 1660. This was the all-important influx by which European wealth and power vaulted ahead of the hitherto larger treasuries of Mughal India, Ottoman Turkey, and Ming China. Spanish bullion spread across Europe and around the globe. By one French analysis, it was not just the King of Spain who was interested in the precious metals, but all the merchants of Sevilla and all the merchants of Antwerp, Augsburg, Genoa, and Rouen, who hastened to garner the profits on what they had exported. Once the returning flota hove into view, Couriers carried the good or bad news to the four corners of the world. War also sped the circulation of silver, as Spain used it to fund military campaigns in Morocco, Italy, and Holland. Nor was the effect limited to Europe. The Manila galleons, based in the Spanish Philippines, carried so much commerce and coin, each year half the sum of the Atlantic traffic, that Spanish silver became the principal currency of Southeast Asia. Spain thus became the figurative lode mined by the embryonic Western European financial services industry. The real figures for the trade, if we take into account all its sectors, are impossible to quantify, said historian Henry Kamen. This vast commercial enterprise had the outward form of an empire dominated by Spain. Viewed from the inside, however, it was a structure in which all the essential arteries were controlled by non-Spaniards. Like the Castilian Parliament nearly 80 years earlier, the native merchants of Seville protested in 1627, "Our people are without sustenance and income, the foreigners are rich, and Spain, instead of being a mother to her sons, has ended up as a foster mother, enriching outsiders and neglecting her own." Manifestly, this draining, superimposed financial services economy was not a framework for long-term Spanish economic success. González de Sayorigo, the economist cum reformer, was prescient in identifying the underlying problem. Money, he wrote, was not necessarily wealth unless it was expended on things that yield profits and attract riches from outside to augment the riches from within. Instead of productive investment, the flow of bullion had created a false sense of wealth and diverted Spaniards from work to dreams. At the same time, he erred in labeling the foreign money men as mere parasites. In fact, they were uniquely able to do what the Castilian ruling class wanted: employ European networks to finance Castile's non-economic priorities of crossbow and crucifix. For 17th century Dutch and 18th and 19th century Britons, by contrast, the late stage influence of finance evolved from earlier commercial and industrial strength. As we have seen, activities solidly rooted in the real economy. For the Dutch, fisheries, whaling, shipbuilding, and textile production. For the British, coal, maritime success, textiles, railroads, and iron and steel, prospered amid business climates of technological innovation, capital formation, and a timely energy source. Production of goods for export thrived. After two or three generations, the innovation weakened and the industries lost some competitiveness. Each nation's worldwide connections and buildup of capital and financial services encouraged a rising emphasis on stock and bond markets, insurance, brokerage, globe-girdling finance, and the emergence of large rentier communities. As the imperial apogees approached, the potential return from investing money domestically came to seem inadequate, and both nations' creditor and financial classes began to move more and more funds into overseas investments. For the 18th century Dutch, these were principally British stocks and government debt, and for the British of 1900 to 1914, one could mention Indian tea plantations, American railroads, and Argentine ranches and banks. As industry lost its edge, foreign scientists and students often left for home. Some native-born scientists, engineers, and skilled craftsmen decided to emigrate, from Holland to England, Germany, and Sweden, from Britain to the United States. Wars became ever more of a budgetary and economic strain. Debt and currency crises grew increasingly frequent. However, if the United States seems to be wandering down an altogether familiar pathway, that is not strictly the case. In the quarter century since 1980, manufacturing in the United States has diminished and been displaced by finance far beyond what happened in early 20th century Britain. We will return to the comparative statistics, but Alan Greenspan's own comments have relevance. In the early 80s, as a private economist, he talked about reducing the federal budget deficit to help make U.S. manufacturing competitive again. By July 2003, as chairman of the Federal Reserve Board, he voiced a different analysis. Is it important for an economy to have manufacturing? There is a big dispute on this issue. What is important is that economies create value, and whether value is created by taking raw materials and fabricating them into something consumers want, or value is created by various services which consumers want, presumably should not make any difference so far as standards of living are concerned. This, indeed, is the dispute. Part is theoretical. The so-called post-industrial scenario versus the argument that hard industries still remain imperative. But another significant element, to which we now turn, is the influence that can entrench around a large rentier class, or, as in America now, around a debt and creditor complex. The precariousness of rentier cultures. The word rentier, meaning a person living off unearned income, comes from the French, as do so many other words connected with money and plunder. Financier, profiteer, buccaneer. Over the last four centuries, however, it was first Spain, then Holland and Great Britain, and now the United States, that created the most notable rentier cultures. Each ultimately became vulnerable as a result. Spain needs little further discussion, save for how its mounds of indebtedness bred an unproductive economic culture. When the initial large amounts of gold and silver arrived between 1540 and 1560, the financial system of Castile was late medieval, not commercially adept in the manner of Renaissance Italy's mercantile and banking centers. However, the flood of bullion enabled the crown to borrow hitherto unimaginable sums for grandiose purposes, often military campaigns. By 1574, with the crown having gone through a kind of bankruptcy in 1557, King Philip II was already paying interest to his bankers in an amount that exceeded his revenues. Debt instruments, most of them juros in at least a dozen varieties, had been official money-raising tools since the days of Ferdinand and Isabella. The royal treasury not only sold juros, but required subjects to accept them in payment when the king sequestered private shipments of bullion, seized businesses or estates, ordered renegotiation of short-term loans, a practice concomitant with the royal bankruptcies, and pressured nobles, merchants, or monasteries into making loans. With interest usually in the 5 to 7% range, many foreign bankers and financiers also subscribed. The volume of juros swelled rapidly. In the words of one economic historian, never before had Western Europe enjoyed the buoyant sense of access to such unparalleled financial resources promising liquidity for both private and public enterprise. In 1598, perhaps as much as 4.6 million ducados annually were being paid to juro holders from a royal budget of 9.7 million. In the 17th century, Philip IV managed to expand the public debt to 12 times Castile's annual revenues. At the century's end, these instruments, now the foundations of Spain's long-term debt, allowed Spain's clases privilegiadas to live off interest income. The upshot, said a second historian, was the growth of a powerful rentier class in Castile, investing its money not in trade or industry, but in bonds, the redemption of which most holders strongly opposed. In 1617, the Council of Finance acknowledged seeing no chance for an economic revival in Castile so long as censos and juros paid better interest than that to be had from investments in agriculture, industry, and trade. A few decades later, the debt economy itself came unglued. The Dutch, obviously, were a different people. Yet they got to much the same place, albeit by a different route. To raise the money for their revolution against Spain and Catholicism, they set up a funded debt and backed it with heavy levels of taxation. Not only did this patriotic commitment bring in the necessary funds, but it soon made Dutch bonds among the most creditworthy in Europe. Financing available at 5% interest also established early 17th century Amsterdam as the West's principal trade entrepot and stock market, making many Dutch merchants and bankers rich. In contrast to bullion-drenched but fiscally fumbling Castile, the Netherlands was ruled by the same somber Calvinists and capitalists who both underwrote the bonds and bought many of them. According to investment historian James MacDonald, some 65,000 Dutch citizen creditors held bonds in a nation that had only 100,000 urban households. Because the officers of the state themselves held large portions of their fortunes in government debt, every public creditor could be sure that his investment was safe. By the middle of the 17th century, however, the urban and provincial leadership groups were no longer active merchants, but rentiers deriving their income from houses, lands, and money at interest. Generations later, when Dutch industry was notably declining, mid-18th century critics worried, as had Spanish reformers, about a nation divided between rentiers and beggars. Historian Simon Schama has described the aristocratization of the Dutch Republic, which some regarded as a betrayal of the nation's patrimony. By another account, the typical mid-18th century family of the governing or regent class had 57% of its assets in Dutch bonds and more than 25% in shares, obligations, and foreign funds. A Dutch economic writer, Isaac Pinto, worried that such bonds, shares, and foreign funds were the linchpin of civic wealth and status, the principal pillar of the social system, a situation quite unlike that existing in other countries. As Dutch society moved toward the credit crises, panics, and collapses of the last three decades of the 18th century, critics grew more pointed. 70 years ago, one foreign observer recorded in 1771, the wealthiest businessman in Amsterdam did not have gardens or country houses comparable to those their brokers own today. The worst thing is not the building and immense expense of maintaining these fairy tale palaces. It is that the distraction and negligence occasioned by this luxury often causes prejudice to business and trade. A further symptom of the collapse, observed historian Jonathan Israel, was the astounding increase and transfer of Dutch capital abroad. Amsterdam banking houses with foreign connections plied a roaring business throughout the 18th century in exporting the capital the United Provinces had accumulated during the 17th. Besides owning something like 15 to 25% of Britain's public debt and a slightly larger ratio of stock in the Bank of England and the British East India Company, Dutch financiers of the 1770s found another rewarding venue: pushing money on foreign rulers, from Catherine the Great to Frederick of Prussia. Bankers who saw too little return in revitalizing the Zaandam industrial district or Friesland fisheries were happy to underwrite Russian capture of lands along the Black Sea from Turkey. As British historian Charles Boxer has observed, whether Dutch capital was invested at home or abroad, it was lent to bankers and brokers of commercial bills, rather than in developing home industries or fostering Dutch shipping. In the 1860s and 1870s, British skeptics wondered if their nation might be doing its own imitation of the Dutch. However, nearer 1914, as the analogy really gained relevance, it was rarely raised. The number and influence of rentiers kept growing. According to one chronicler, by 1871, Britain contained 170,000 persons of rank and property without visible occupation. Stocks and shares, including shares in family firms formed into private companies for this purpose, were a convenient way of providing for widows, daughters, and other relatives. Although not to the extent of Holland, Britain, too, was a nation of citizen creditors, with many in politics or the government owning shares in the consolidated funds. The big British rentier growth was still to come. With each decade, the percentage of investment going overseas grew like a springtime tulip bed. What had been just over £200 million in 1850 became £700 million in 1875, $1 billion in 1900, $3 billion in 1907, and $4 billion in 1914. By 1914, overseas investments were bringing the British investing classes a net annual return of £200 million, a sum that was barely taxed and exceeded the annual budget of His Majesty's government. Owning 43% of the global total of foreign investments, Britons believed themselves to be almost invulnerable economically. Reform-minded political office holders such as Joseph Chamberlain, the Conservative Party's leading economic nationalist, were dubious about this sense of safety well before 1914, and some academics assessing British decline make a similar complaint. At the very moment when creativity and capital were needed for industrial renewal at home, said historian Paul Thompson, resources were being siphoned away. Clearly, though, the market dictate was clear. Foreign investments earned considerably more than the returns available domestically. Overall, one researcher of British capital migration concluded, preoccupation with dividends nurtured the growth of a rentier governing class whose interests lay outside the community in which they lived and exerted influence. British historian Paul Kennedy, the dean of great power decline theorists, has emphasized the interplay of finance and the demands of war in charting the fates of Spain, the Dutch Republic, and Imperial Britain. Finance not as a late stage of national evolution, but as a sinew, and sometimes an Achilles heel, of a great power's military capacity. Kennedy was moved to note, however, that this is not to say that the financial element always determined the fate of nations. We will revisit this relationship in Chapter 10. Because intermittent high debt ratios were so central to the evolution of each of the leading world economic powers, each became comfortable, too comfortable, with debt as a long-standing experience, practice, and tactic. Particular overconfidence was instilled by memories of how often previous debt problems had been surmounted, even at extreme levels, 100 to 200% of GDP or GNP. A few examples will make the point. By the time of its real peril in the 1630s, and despite growing cynicism, the Spanish kingdom had survived five previous royal bankruptcies, 1557, 1575, 1595, 1607, and 1627. Interest rates were still surprisingly low, and the prior ebbs of silver shipments from Mexico and Peru had been followed by renewed flows. The embattled Dutch nation, in turn, had been surrounded by enemies and water at birth and was used to sticking its finger in financial dikes, as well as in the sea-restraining versions. The fact that its national debt rose to painful heights after the wars of 1689 to 1713 did not elicit the concern it should have. In the London of 1900 to 1914, complacency about Britain's rising debt in the aftermath of the Boer War reflected industrial triumph after previous surges of war-related indebtedness. Men including David Hume and Adam Smith had doubted the nation's ability to survive the debt burden left by the several wars with France. In 1752, Hume had forecast national bankruptcy by the end of the century unless the trend reversed. However, although the Napoleonic Wars carried British debt to a new height, nearly 300% of GDP as measured in the 1820s, even that was surmounted despite severe pressures during the depressionary decade after Waterloo. By the 1850s, the historian Thomas Macaulay could scoff at the same cry of anguish and despair that had always proved wrong. Britain quickly shrank the Napoleonic War debt with the profits from its manufacturing hegemony during the 1840s and 1850s, as factories and exports justified the description of Britain as the workshop of the world. Then the hubris began to set in. Understandable as this cockiness might be, history teaches a crucial distinction. Nations could marshal the necessary debt-defying high-wire walks and comebacks during their youth and early middle age, when their industries, exports, capitalizations, and animal spirits were vital and expansive, but they became less resilient in later years. During these periods, as their societies polarized and their arteries clogged with rentier and debt buildups, wars and financial crises stopped being manageable. Of course, clarity about this develops only in retrospect. However, even though war-related debt seems to have been part of each fatal endgame, the past leading world economic powers seem to have made another error en route. They did not pay enough attention to establishing or maintaining a vital manufacturing sector, thereby keeping a better international balance and a broader internal income distribution than financialization allowed. The importance of hard industries. From 17th century Spain to 20th century Britain, the dynamics of eventual decline supported the arguments of those who had contended that finance could not replace manufacturing and that national economies needed the broader base. The bluntest case for hard industries was made by Britain's former colonial secretary, Joseph Chamberlain, in 1904. Whereas England was once the greatest manufacturing country, he said, its people are now more and more employed in finance, in distribution, in domestic service. But over the long term, Britain could not survive as merely a hoarder of invested securities if it was not also the creator of new wealth. Then he asked his audience of bankers, "Granted that you are the clearinghouse of the world, but are you entirely beyond anxiety as to the permanence of your great position? Banking is not the creator of our prosperity, but the creation of it. It is not the cause of our wealth, but it is the consequence of our wealth. And if the industrial energy and development which has been going on for so many years in this country were to be hindered or relaxed, then finance and all that finance means will follow trade to the countries which are more successful than ourselves." But while this was one of the most accurate predictions in British commercial history, it did not carry the day. Part of what made these contentions unpersuasive to elites was the perception that finance and its services represented a higher stage of evolution, what late 20th century observers would laud as post-industrialism. As Paul Kennedy has explained, complex finances made Britain more rather than less vulnerable by the turn of the 20th century. Yet policymakers then were attracted to the idea that, should other nations industrialize, Britain would become the financial and commercial service center to the world. The United Kingdom was different, as one observer put it, because it was the first frog-spawned egg to grow legs, the first tadpole to change into a frog, the first frog to hop out of the pond. Harvard economic historian David Landes saw the first steps toward post-industrialism as having been taken even earlier. By the late 1700s, most wealthy Dutch were big landowners, high state officials or rentiers. Gone were the prosperous enterprisers of the Golden Age. Employers were now confined to the middle or lower ranks. In the process, the United Provinces abdicated as world leader in trade and manufacture and went into a post-industrial mode. Italy had gone that way before. In Venice, for example, the wool craft had sunk under the burden of taxes. Key industries had migrated to cheaper lands, and businessmen had reinvested their fortunes in agriculture on the mainland. Both Venice and Florence were already taking on the role of tourist magnets, living on the wealth of erstwhile competitors. In the aggregate, Holland was still wealthy, as Adam Smith's observations show, but estimates of income or product per head in 1750 to 1870 have it going nowhere. Other, more active nations were passing it by. Post-industrialism, then, may be more a quest for genteel retirement than a real economics-based future for a major power. Weary global economic powers seem uniquely vulnerable. Those who insist that the manufacturing imperative still applies to the present-day United States invoke three powerful examples: Germany, Switzerland, and Japan. All three nations have wages or overall production costs higher than those in the United States. All have reasonably successful financial sectors and post-industrial accomplishments. Tourism, ecological awareness, and renewable energy emphases. Wind in Germany, solar power in Japan. However, they balance these with highly developed manufacturing industries. For Germany, machinery, vehicles, chemicals, and metal products are the great exports. For Switzerland, chemicals, metal products, machinery, and mechanical engineering products, especially clocks and watches. And for Japan, vehicles, electronics, and computers. Each nation's products command global respect for quality. Indeed, German, Japanese, and Swiss export prowess puts the once mighty United States to shame. In 2003 and 2004, the U.S. trade deficit in manufactured goods rose from $470 billion to $552 billion. The three better balanced economies, by contrast, enjoyed huge surpluses in trade and manufactured goods and large ones in their overall current accounts. A set of statistics will demonstrate the point. Estimates for 2004, provided by the CIA in mid-2005, put Germany first in the world with $893 billion in exports, mostly manufactured goods. This from a national population of 82 million. The United States placed second with exports of $795 billion. Not exactly a triumph because, one, the United States had a population of 296 million, and two, these exports were dwarfed by $1.3 trillion worth of imports. The Japanese, chalking up the world's third highest export total, $538 billion, did so with a national population of 127 million. Pocket-sized Switzerland was even more of a per capita powerhouse. With a national population of only 7.5 million, it exported $131 billion worth of goods in 2004. Keep in mind the entire equation. The Germans, Japanese, and Swiss do this with workforce wages and benefits and industrial production costs as high as or higher than those in the United States. Needless to say, all three countries are net creditor nations, enjoy strong current accounts surpluses, and have citizens who achieve relatively high savings rates. During the quarter century after 1980, while the U.S. economy was undergoing financialization, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, OECD, credited all three with stronger growth rates than the United States. One would not guess that from American media coverage. Old Europe, in particular, is supposedly verging on economic palsy. Even Britain, as it happens, has avoided the reckless deindustrialization allowed in the United States. Although British manufacturing exports lack the comparative heft they registered in 1870 or 1900, economic historians underscore that in 1990, merchandise exports represented 21% of British GDP, whereas in the United States they amounted to only 8%. Between 2000 and 2003, the share of U.S. GDP represented by manufactured exports dropped from 7% to 6%, and it is chilling to contemplate what the ratios might be in 2010 or 2020. Chapter 10 will focus more on China and East Asia, but for the moment let us simply say that overall Chinese manufacturing and export levels may well vie with those of the United States by the 2020s. Moreover, China is already responsible for the bulk of the rapidly growing U.S. deficit, $37 billion in 2004, in what Washington calls ATP, Advanced Technology Products. Here we are talking about major categories such as biotechnology, weapons, optoelectronics, and nuclear technology, not mere circuit boards or routine components. Clyde Prestowitz, the longtime president of the Washington-based Economic Strategy Institute, all but tolled the bell for U.S. manufacturing only a few years into the new century. The supposed 2003 to 2004 comeback of the U.S. technology sector after the NASDAQ stock collapse fell short across a range that included semiconductor production, laptops, and high-definition television. Serious renewal in the Midwestern Rust Belt, meanwhile, was belied by the early 2000s disasters in the steel and automobile industries. In 3 billion New Capitalists, The Great Shift of Wealth and Power to the East, Prestowitz profiled a trio of critical weaknesses in America's dying tech ecosystem. 1. Research and development. 2. Present and future workforce education. And 3. The particular peril posed to high technology leadership by the nation's increasing inability to implement, test, or support that expertise in an actual manufacturing milieu. This seems to be a pervasive concern among both academic experts and captains of industry. The actual making of advanced technologies in the United States had slipped far enough that in 2003, Thomas S. Hartwick, former scientist at TRW and chairman of the Department of Defense's Advisory Group on Electronic Devices, told Congress that the structure of the U.S. high-tech industry is coming unglued, with innovation and design losing their tie to prototype fabrication and manufacturing. These losses leave inventions on the cutting floor because they cannot be manufactured. The Department of Defense was particularly nervous because the advanced semiconductor production needed for a new generation of weapons was migrating to Asia. Randall Isaac, former vice president for strategic alliances at IBM Technology, said, "You can't do effective R&D if you don't have the manufacturing to ensure that the R&D is actually relevant. If the United States loses its manufacturing lead, it will lose everything else with it." Governments elsewhere in the world try to maintain a wise balance, but not Washington. Even the military side of the economy gives rise to what humorists like to call déjà vu all over again. Those familiar with British historian Corelli Barnett's searing indictment of British unpreparedness for World War I, his catalog of lackadaisical approaches and naivete in everything from chemicals, coal tars, and munitions to ball bearings, and of Whitehall's lack of attention to how many essential processes, metals, and machine tools were in German or other foreign hands, must cringe at the latter-day U.S. parallels. Four indicators compiled by Prestowitz make the point. The U.S. need to use Russian, Chinese, and European rockets to launch its space satellites. Boeing's decision to outsource production of the wings on its 787 Dreamliner. The lack of U.S. firms that have the capacity to manufacture the advanced systems for military night vision capacity. French licensees have sold equipment to China. And the U.S. dependence on China for a large number of strategic metals, including tungsten, yttrium, magnesium, antimony, and indium. Such evidence may carry more weight than laments about lost manufacturing and industry. Too many Americans wrongly view these sectors through a rusty rearview mirror, calling to mind the 175-year-old red brick monuments to textile production still visible in New England, the derelict steel mills of Indiana and Pennsylvania, or the sections of Cleveland's Cuyahoga River that used to catch fire because of the flammable debris that accumulated in it. But the industrial age is still with us. China has many tens of millions of automobiles to produce in order to justify those extraordinary Shanghai highways, and India has yet to even construct the roads. The financial media in Delhi and Mumbai underscore the need and prospects for local steel production by reminding readers that the Chinese economy is already nearly 10 times as steel-intensive as India's. Post-industrialism may be imminent in 6 or 8 square miles of information technology-driven Bangalore, but even modern manufacturing is rare across most of the nation, where the population will soon exceed China's. Part of the problem in recognizing the true industrial shape of the world today, of course, lies in post-industrial theory and the proverbial dead economists to whom many Washington conservatives somehow allowed their thought processes to become enslaved. We now turn to them. The invisible 18th century hand in American 21st century strategy. Adam Smith. The worthy 18th-century Scottish economist who inclined to the American side in the Revolutionary War and sympathized with colonial complaints about British mercantilism, commanded a very enthusiastic press in the United States through the last quarter of the 20th century. Ties bearing his embroidered profile were said to have sold far better in Washington than in, say, London or Edinburgh. For the 21st century, however, some diminution of worship may be expected. Smith's vaunted invisible hand, the inerrant guidance of the market, has become too fumble-fingered for a growing percentage of doubters, especially advocates of strategic thinking and the need to consider political, economic, and cultural externalities, ignored by more than 3 decades of marketplace orthodoxy. As a side benefit of their great power analyses, historians such as David Landes, Paul Kennedy, and Jonathan Israel have held forth at some length describing how Smith's market theory and blinders caused him to misjudge or ignore many political, military, competitive, or strategic factors that influenced the rise or decline of the Dutch and British global economies. Luckily, Attention is also growing to the inadequacy of pure market theory in explaining developments in the United States. Billionaire investor Warren Buffett, a critic of the proliferation of financial services and speculations in the United States, also poked fun at Smith and his hallowed marketplace. Instead of finding the invisible hand in stratagems such as derivatives, he likened such instruments to an invisible foot kicking society in the shins. We will return to Buffett's critique in Chapter 10. Trade specialist Prestowitz, preoccupied with strategic thinking, criticizes American economists for ignoring real-world adjustment costs like closed factories, blighted neighborhoods, lost skills, and uprooted communities. They cling to this myopia, he contends, partly because they prefer the simpler world of Adam Smith and David Ricardo, with its magic unseen hand and climate-controlled comparative advantage-based trade. In The Wealth of Nations, adds Prestowitz, Smith argued that the objective of economic activity is consumption, but the development models of Asian economies all involve the suppression of consumption, along with a heavy emphasis on saving, investment, and production. In Singapore, for example, the government mandates large contributions to a pension fund. In Japan, consumer credit is limited even today. Asian savings rates at 30% to over 50% of GDP are higher than Western rates have ever been except in wartime, which is perhaps not surprising given that industrial development is seen in Asia as a key element of national security and avoidance of Western dominance. Worst of all, he concludes, the Bush administration has no policy or strategy and little understanding of many of the factors that should be involved in one. Similarly, Jared Diamond, author of Collapse, How Some Societies Succeed or Choose to Fail, noted in a 2003 lecture that officials of the George W. Bush administration had acknowledged concentrating on situations headed for crises within 90 days. No framework this short-term in orientation is compatible with strategic thinking. In the case of the Bush administration, perhaps the magic of the marketplace leaves no room for the clutter of awkward cultural and political externalities. Faith may also be an explanation. In the triangle of evangelical belief, state, and marketplace, laissez-faire has two wellsprings, not one. But there have been no heavenly interventions on behalf of past leading international debtors. The United States is on its own. Chapter 10. Serial Bubbles and Foreign Debt Holders. American Embarrassment and Asian Opportunity. Decades of relentless urgings to borrow more and spend more, from the onslaught of junk mail credit card pitches to the devotion of whole magazines to goods rather than words, have turned Americans into voracious consuming machines. In 1981, Americans saved a net 8.5% of national income, according to the Bureau of Economic Analysis, and as recently as 1998, the figure was 6.5%. By 2003, the net savings rate had fallen to just 1.2%. Daniel Gross, The New York Times, 2004. Perhaps the crucial difference between then, Britain in 1914, and now, is that Britain was a net exporter of capital, while the United States today is the opposite. For the United States has used its dominance of the international bond market not to export capital, which in net terms it did until around 1972, but to import it. Neil Ferguson, Cash Nexus, 2000. Persistent newspaper headlines about debt are innately worrisome. Their frequent appearances during the 1920s, 1930s, 1980s, and 1990s proved to be unhappy auguries. The tensions of the first decade of the 21st century, partly new, lay in the combination of American domestic credit excess and vulnerable international status. The world's biggest debtor had also become its largest ongoing borrower. A risky pairing. The U.S. consumer, taking on record levels of debt and debt service and working record hours, sometimes holding two jobs, was hailed in 2003 and 2004 as the wheelhorse of the world economy, the global buyer of last resort. This dubious privilege was an unexpected outcome of the post-September 11th mobilization. The world economy is leveraged to the U.S. consumer, reported CNN, and the U.S. economy is leveraged to the hilt. U.S. consumer spending accounts for around 70% of U.S. gross domestic product. Indeed, consumer credit and mortgage debt are both a higher percentage of disposable income now than they've ever been before. For households watching their disposable income shrink, their new international locomotive status was a small consolation. Because imported goods constituted a high percentage of those consumed by Americans, the several measurements of the U.S. trade deficits kept setting new highs. Export firms and central banks in China, Japan, Taiwan, and Korea accumulated so many dollars in payment that U.S. stock markets trembled at rumors that this or that Asian central bank might be selling greenbacks for other currencies. Economists in Tokyo and Beijing, all too aware of their nation's huge stakes, kept as close a watch as did dollar overseers in Washington. Like debt headlines, currency weakness is rarely a good sign. Britain, as a fading hegemon, had been troubled by sterling pressures and crises during the 1920s, 1930s, and 1940s, when the pound was yielding its global role to the dollar. Now the same shoe was pinching the American foot. As U.S. wage income fell, American households pushed their debt and consumption levels to new heights. The U.S. current account deficit, our thermometer of global imbalance, kept rising as a share of GDP. 5% in 2003, 5.7% in 2004, and an estimated 6.5% in 2005. Asian central bankers, however, thought it generally wise to hold the dollars earned from selling popular products in the United States and reinvest many of them in American Treasury debt, thereby loaning those funds back to the United States government. The Chinese and Japanese could sell so much in America partly because the United States made fewer and fewer of the manufactured goods that its citizens wanted or needed. Neither export-focused nation wanted Washington to impose tariffs or quotas on their products. Ordinary Americans took in the large, bold-faced debt headlines, the ones about extravagant credit card fees, bubbling housing prices and mortgage loans, and the pivotal role being assumed by China, but absorbed relatively little of the technical explanation behind them. Press reporting on the debt didn't make it any easier. John and Jane Q. Public could not keep up with shifting domestic and international debt measurements, arcane definitions, and coded reports. Even experts winced at fathoming the latest wrinkles in credit derivatives, exotic mortgage instruments, and Beijing monetary policy. Besides, to grasp what the new debt levels threatened, worriers first had to find out how much indebtedness there actually was and what it represented. This involved considerable subjectivity. Moreover, any serious tabulation required going beyond just the sovereign or national debt that had monopolized discussion of Dutch vulnerability in 1715 or British peril in 1919. The fiscal jeopardy of the 21st century United States was more complex. On the occasion of George W. Bush's second inaugural, the national debt was $7.8 trillion, if we include both the debt held by the public, $4.6 trillion, and the debt held by government agencies, $3.2 trillion, principally the Social Security and Medicare trust funds. To those who counted nothing else, that total represented just 70% or so of the projected 2005 GDP. The threshold of real danger, experts agreed, came when government debt climbed into the range of 100 to 150% of GDP. Britain's national debt had reached 200% of GDP during the 18th century and roughly 300% around 1820, neither of which encumbrances kept the United Kingdom from achieving its historical zenith and economic golden age between 1850 and 1870. Under certain circumstances, then, even levels over 200% could be managed successfully, especially in a manufacturing boom. However, economists and journalists venturing a calculus for the U.S. debt usually weigh several additions. Given our federal system, combined state and local debt in the neighborhood of $1.7 trillion seems to warrant inclusion. A second plausible addition is the $3.7 trillion needed to make up a shortfall in the Social Security Trust Fund to cover its expected obligations over the next 75 years. Including these raised the 2005 national debt to $13.5 trillion, a total representing 115% of GDP and approaching the danger zone. The other possible add-on involved the expected obligations of Medicare funding over the next 75 years. These the New York Times described as follows. Because nearly everyone expects health care costs to keep rising faster than economic growth, the trustees of the Medicare Fund warn that the nation faces an enormous shortfall. They report that the country would have to pay in $9 trillion today to make the trust fund big enough to cover its future obligations, and set aside an additional $21 trillion to cover supplementary obligations, for example, the prescription drug benefit, that lie outside the scope of the trust fund. Against the backdrop of the national debts of Spain, the Dutch Republic, and Britain in their later days as great powers, including this $30 trillion, seems excessive. 18th and 19th century calculations never extended so far ahead. Even the 75-year cost of Social Security is a reach, but the Medicare obligation is too remote and also susceptible to a major policy shift toward national health insurance and drug price controls. What also seems untenable is to isolate public debt from private debt. Too many critical interrelationships have developed over the last century, especially in the United States. No historical private debt comparisons are plausible, even with the Britain of 1913. There, only 10% of the population owned homes, limiting real estate borrowing. Debtors' prisons had functioned well into the 19th century, and a fair part of private debt was extended within families. The total assets of British building societies, the housing lenders, in 1913 were just £65 million, $325 million. This equaled less than 2% of the £4 billion in overseas investments principally held by the rentier class. This £4 billion was four times the size of the British national debt. These assets were Britannia's financial shield. In the 19th century United States, by contrast, much of the private lending and debt involved homes, lands, and crops in a society of a moving frontier, in which many adult white males voted and owned some acreage. Cheap credit and easy money became a democratic and capital D Democratic war cry from Andrew Jackson to William Jennings Bryan, both famous as bank bashers outraged over the machinations of the moneyed classes. The millions of farmers, Bryan told the 1896 Democratic National Convention, were businessmen too. Indeed, by 1914, the total of farm mortgage debt alone was $4.5 billion. Lending to the masses has long had its greatest commercial emphasis in the United States. This is a vital backdrop to the current importance of U.S. private debt. Taken together, household, corporate, and financial sector debt represents roughly three-quarters of so-called total credit market debt, $40 trillion in the United States. If there is a credit bubble, much of its vulnerable volume must be private. In the United States of 2005, moreover, private debt had been swollen through the actions of the quasi-public Federal Reserve Board, encouraged by a president who was urging citizens to borrow and spend, and further abetted by Vice President Cheney's broad assurance that Reagan proved deficits don't matter. Private debt's foremost characteristic, however, is its sheer mass. No national vulnerability quotient can exclude it. As noted in Chapter 8, the vastness of private credit market debt in 2003 already dwarfed the official money supply profiles, enough to suggest a case for credit as a new Federal Reserve yardstick. Financial markets watchers also made some interesting seat-of-the-pants observations. On top of other recognitions of parallels between debt and the financial services industry, a CNN Money analysis suggested that the chart of the current account gap as a percentage of GDP, incidentally, looks almost exactly like a chart of consumer credit as a percentage of income. Borrowing to consume, not inadequate savings, was at the heart of current account deterioration. Private financial borrowing manifestly cannot be borrowing in the full faith and credit sense, involving the backing of the U.S. government. Still, the lesson of the last quarter